from Tallahassee to Miami, where they rented a car and drove south through the Keys to the town of Marathon, population 9,000. 2 years earlier, a retired lawyer named Perry Kroenke had been found dead, beaten and strangled in his fishing boat as it drifted in shallow water near the Great White Heron Preserve. His skull had been shattered. There was blood everywhere. The cause of death was asphyxiation, caused by a length of nylon rope pulled around his neck so violently that the skin ripped. There were no witnesses, no suspicious characters, no suspects, no forensics. The case was still considered active, and few details had been released. Jerry's go-to man, Kenny Lee, had been unable to obtain crime scene photos from the FBI clearinghouse. The Marathon Police Department was the domain of Chief Turnbull, a snowbird from Michigan who had never gone back home. He was also the homicide detective, among other duties. He greeted Lacey and Darren warmly, but with suspicion, and, like Sheriff Black in Biloxi, cleared the air immediately by establishing that the two were not cops. "We don't pretend to be," Lacey said with a megawatt smile. "We investigate complaints against judges, and with 1,000 of them in this state, that keeps us very busy." Nervous laughter all around. "Gotta get those crooked judges." "So why are you interested in the Kroenke case?" Turnbull asked. Darren had once again been told to keep quiet. His boss would do the talking, all of it. They had rehearsed their fiction, and both thought it sounded plausible. She said, "Just some routine stuff, really. We're digging through a new complaint filed against a judge in Miami, and we've run across some possible criminal activity by the late Mr. Kroenke. Did you, by any chance, know him before he was murdered?" "No, he lived out at Grassy Key." "Are you familiar with this area?" "No." "It's a swanky retirement enclave on a bay north of here. The residents tend to stick to themselves. Out of my price range." "The murder was 2 years ago. Do you have any suspects?" The chief actually laughed, as though the idea of a decent lead was so far-fetched it was humorous. He collected himself quickly and said, "I'm not sure I should answer that question, as bold as it is. Where are you going with this?" "We're just doing our jobs, Chief Turnbull." "How confidential is this conversation?" "Totally. We have nothing to gain by repeating any of this. We work for the state of Florida, and it's our job to investigate allegations of wrongdoing, same as you." The chief pondered this for a moment, his nervous eyes darting from one to the other. He finally took a deep breath, relaxed, and said, "Yes. Early on, we had a suspect, or at least we thought we were on the trail. We've always assumed that the killer was in a boat. He found Mr. Kroenke alone, fishing for red drum, something he did all the time. There were several fish he'd caught in the cooler. His wife said he'd left home around 7 that morning and was expecting a pleasant day on the water. We went to every marina within 50 miles of here and checked the records for boat rentals." He paused long enough to pull reading glasses out of a shirt pocket and open a file. He scanned it quickly, found his number. "There were 27 boats rented that morning, all, of course, to fishermen. The murder was August the 5th. Red drum season, you understand?" "Of course." Lacey had never heard of a red drum and wasn't sure what one was. "We checked all 27 names. Took us a while, but hey, that's our job. One guy was a convicted felon. Served some time in a federal pen for assaulting an FBI agent. Pretty nasty dude. We got excited and spent some time with him, but he eventually checked out." Lacey doubted if Ross Bannock was careless enough to rent a boat in the vicinity at about the same time he murdered Perry Kroenke after stalking him for over 20 years, but she feigned deep interest. After spending 15 minutes with Chief Turnbull and seeing his operation, she was not impressed. "Did you ask the state police for help?" she asked. "Of course, right off the bat. They're the pros, you know. They did the autopsy, forensics, most of the preliminary investigation. We worked side by side, a joint effort in all aspects. Great guys. I like them. That's nice. Could we take a look at the file? She asked sweetly. Thick wrinkles broke out across his forehead. He yanked off his readers and chewed on a stem, glaring at her as if she had asked about his wife's sex life. Why? He demanded.
There might be something about this case that's relevant to our investigation.
I don't get it. Murder here, crooked judge there. What's the connection?
We don't know, Chief Turnbull. We're just digging, the way you often do. Just good police work.
I can't release the file, sorry. Get a court order or something and I'll be happy to help, but without one, no go.
Fair enough. She shrugged as if to give up. There was nothing else to talk about. Thanks for your time.
Don't mention it. We'll be back with a court order. Great.
One last question, though, if you don't mind.
Try me.
The rope used by the killer, is it in the evidence file?
You bet. We have it.
And you're familiar with it?
Of course. It's the murder weapon.
Can you describe it?
Sure, but I won't. Come back with your court order.
I'll bet it's nylon, about 30 inches in length, double twin braid, marine grade, either blue and white or green and white in color.
The wrinkles broke out again as his jaw dropped. He rocked back in his chair and clasped his hands together behind his head.
Well, I'll be damned. Close enough? Lacey asked.
Yes, close enough. You've seen this guy's work before, I take it.
Maybe. Maybe we have a suspect. I can't talk about him now, but maybe next week or next month.
We're on the same team, Chief. What do you want?
I want to see the file. All of it.
And everything is confidential. Turnbull bounced to his feet and said, "Follow me." 2 hours later, they parked at a marina and followed Turnbull, their new buddy, down a dock to a 30-foot patrol boat with the word police painted boldly on both sides. The captain was an old cop in official shorts, and he welcomed them aboard as if they were headed for a luxury cruise. Lacey and Darren sat knee to knee on a bench starboard side and enjoyed the ride over the smooth water. Turnbull stood next to the captain and they chatted in indecipherable cop speak. 15 minutes into the trip, the boat decelerated and floated almost to a stop. Turnbull walked to the front and pointed at the water.
Somewhere right around here is where they found him. As you can see, it's pretty remote.
Lacey and Darren stood and took in the surroundings. Endless water in all directions. The nearest shore was a mile away and dotted with homes that were barely visible. There was no other watercraft to be seen.
Who found him? Lacey asked.
Coast Guard. His wife got worried when he didn't show, and she made some calls. We found his truck and trailer at the marina and figured he was still on the water. We called the Coast Guard and began searching.
Not a bad place for a murder, mused Darren. Practically his first words of the day.
Turnbull grunted and said, "Damn near perfect, if you ask me." He owned the boat, had bought it a year earlier as the master plan came together. It wasn't a particularly nice one, not nearly as fancy as the one owned by the target, but he wasn't trying to impress. To avoid a trailer and parking and all that hassle, he rented a slip at a marina south of Marathon. Ownership would negate the need to rent. He would sell it later, as well as the small condo near the harbor, both hopefully at a profit. Established in the area, knowing no one, he fished the waters, something he came to enjoy, and he stalked his target, something he lived for. The paperwork, the bill of sale for the boat, the local bank account,
the land records, the fishing license, property taxes, the fuel receipts, was all easily forged. State and local paperwork were child's play for a man with 100 bank accounts, a man who bought and sold things with fake names just for the fun of it. He bumped into Kroenke on the dock one day and got close enough to say hello. The ass did not reply. Back in the day, he was known to be a prick. Things hadn't changed. Staying away from that law firm had been a blessing. On the day, he watched Kroenke unload his boat, buy some fuel, arrange his rods and lures, and eventually speed away from the dock, too fast and leaving a wake. What an ass. He followed him at a distance, one that grew because Kroenke's engines were bigger. When Kroenke found his spot, stopped, and began casting, he backed away even more and watched him with binoculars. 2 months earlier, he had drifted in close and used the artifice of engine trouble to seek help. Kroenke, ever the prick, left him stranded a mile from shore. On the day, with Kroenke busy with his red drum, he navigated straight to the bigger boat. Realizing he was getting too close, Kroenke froze and glared at him as if he were an idiot. "Hey, I'm taking on water," he yelled, idling closer. Kroenke shrugged as if to say, "That's your problem." He laid down his rod. When the boats touched hard, Kroenke growled, "What the hell?" His final words. He was 81 years old, fit for his age, but still a step or two slower. Quickly, the killer looped his rope over a cleat, jumped onto Kroenke's boat, whipped out Letty, flicked it twice, and smacked the lead ball into the side of Kroenke's head, crunching his skull. He loved the sound. He hit him again, though it was unnecessary. He pulled out the nylon rope, wrapped it twice around his neck, put his knee at the top of his spinal cord, and yanked hard enough to tear skin. "Dear Mr. Bannock, we enjoyed your term as a clerk this past summer. We were impressed with your work and had every intention of offering you an associate's position beginning next fall. However, as you may have heard, our firm has just merged with Reed and Gabanoff, a global giant based in London. This is causing a major shift in personnel. Unfortunately, we are not in the position of hiring all of last summer's interns. We wish you a very bright future. Sincerely, H. Perry Kroenke, Managing Partner." As he pulled tighter and tighter, he kept saying, "And here's to your very bright future, H. Perry." 23 years had passed, and the rejection still hurt. The sting was still there. Every other summer intern was offered a job. The merger never happened. Someone, no doubt another cutthroat intern, had started the rumor that Bannock didn't like girls, didn't date them. He tied off the rope with a double clove hitch and for a few seconds admired his work. He glanced around and saw the nearest boat half a mile away, going for the open water. He grabbed the rope to his boat and pulled it closer. Then he eased into the water and went under, washing off any blood that may have splattered. "And here's to your very bright future, H. Perry." A year later, he sold both the boat and the condo at modest profits. Both transactions were done in the name of Robert West, one of 34 in the state. He loved the alias game. 19. From her extensive reading about serial killers, Jerry knew that almost none of them stopped until they were caught or killed, either by the police or by themselves, or otherwise forced into retirement by age or perhaps prison. The demons that drove them were relentless and cruel and could never be exorcised. They could be neutralized by death or incarceration, but nothing else. The few killers who attempted to come to grips with their carnage did so from a prison cell,
According to her timeline, Bannock had once gone 11 years without killing. He murdered Eileen Nickelberry near Wilmington in 1998, then waited until 2009 to catch the reporter Danny Cleveland alone in his apartment in Little Rock. Since then, he had killed 3 more times. His pace was quickening, which was not unusual. She reminded herself that her timeline was essentially worthless because she had no real idea how many victims were out there. Could there be bodies still unfound? Some killers hid them, then forgot years later where all of them were buried. Other killers, like Bannock, wanted the victims found and with clues. As an amateur profiler, Jerry believed Bannock wanted someone, the police, the press, the families, to know the killings were related. But why? It was probably his warped ego, a desire for acknowledgement that he was smarter than the police. He took such great pride in his methods that it would be a shame not to be admired, even if by strangers from a distance. It was likely that he wanted his work to become legendary. She had never believed that Bannock wanted to get caught. He had status, prestige, popularity, money, education, far more going for him than the average serial killer, if there was such a thing. But he loved the gamesmanship. He was a sociopath who killed for revenge, but he thrived on the planning and execution and the perfection of his crimes. 8 murders, at least in her book, in 7 states, over 22 years. He was only 49 years old and probably in his prime as a killer. Each murder gave him even more confidence, more thrills. A veteran now, he probably believed that he could never be caught. Who else was on his list? The paper was standard copy, plain white, 8.5 by 11, purchased a year earlier at a Staples in Dallas. The envelope was just as plain and untraceable. The word processor was an ancient Olivetti, one of the first generation with a small screen and little memory circa 1985. She had bought it second or third hand in an antiques warehouse in Montgomery. Wearing disposable plastic gloves, she carefully placed several sheets of copy paper in the tray and opened the screen and stared at it for a long time. The knot twisted in her stomach, and she couldn't keep going. Finally, she managed to type slowly, awkwardly, one key at a time. Judge Bannock, the Florida Board on Judicial Conduct is investigating your recent activities, re Verno, Dunwoody, Kroenke. Could there be others? I think so. Typically, she ate little and was surprised when her stomach flipped. And she raced to the bathroom where she vomited and retched until her chest and back ached. Moving around gingerly, she drank some water and eventually made it back to her desk. She stared at what she had written, a note she had composed 1,000 times in her mind, words she had uttered and practiced again and again. How would he react? Receiving the anonymous letter would be catastrophic, devastating, life-altering, terrifying. Or at least she hoped so. He was too cool and cold-blooded to panic, but his world would never be the same. His world would be rocked, and he and his demons would drive themselves even crazier now that someone was on his trail. There was no one he could tell, no one to confide in, no one to run to. She wanted to rock his world. She wanted Bannock to watch every step, look over his shoulder, jump at every noise, study every stranger. She wanted him to stay awake at night, listening to every sound and trembling in fear the way she had lived for so long. She thought of Lacey and again debated the strategy of exposing her. Jerry had convinced herself that Bannock was too smart to do anything stupid,
Plus, Lacey was a tough girl who could take care of herself. At some point soon, Jerry would warn her. She printed the note on a sheet of the copy paper and put it in the envelope. Typing his name gave her another chill.
R. Bannock, 825 Eastman Lane, Cullman, Florida, 32533.
The stamp was generic and applied without saliva. She was sweating and lay down on the sofa for a long time. The next note was also on white copy paper, but from a different manufacturer. She typed, "Now that I know who you are, I send greetings from my grave. So long ago and so far, from that night with you and Dave, you stalked and waited all those years to find me in a place unseen and act out all your anger and fears on a girl you knew as Eileen." Unsteady as she was, she managed to laugh out loud at the image of Bannock reading her poem. She laughed at his horror, his disbelief, and his rage that a victim had caught up with him. On Saturday, Jerry left Mobile and drove an hour to Pensacola. In a suburban shopping center, she found a blue postal box sitting between a drop-off for FedEx and one for UPS. The nearest security camera was far away, over the door of a coffee shop. Wearing gloves and staying in her car, she placed the first letter into the slot. It would be postmarked Monday at the Pensacola Distribution Center and delivered to the box beside the front door of Bannock's home no later than the following Tuesday. 2 hours later, she pulled off the expressway at Greenville, Alabama, and dropped off her poem at the city post office. It would be collected Monday and trucked to Montgomery, where it would be postmarked and sent back south to Pensacola. Bannock should have it by the following Wednesday, Thursday at the latest. She took the back roads home to Mobile and enjoyed the drive. She listened to jazz on Sirius and kept checking her smile in the mirror. The first two of her letters had been mailed. She had found the courage to confront the killer, or at least set in motion his endgame. The hunting phase was over, and for that, she was elated. Now she moved into the next phase, still unnamed. Her work was not over by any means, but the heavy lifting had been done, all 22 years of it. Now Lacey had the case, and she would eventually bring in the state police, maybe the FBI, and Bannock would never know who stalked him. Late that night, she was reading a novel, sipping her second glass of wine, and fighting the temptation to go online and dig more. Her phone pinged with an email arriving on one of her secure accounts. It was KL, or Kenny Lee, and he asked if she was awake. She was suddenly weary of sleuthing and just wanted to be left alone, but he was an old friend, one she would never meet. She wrote back, "Hey there, how's life?" "Living the dream. Got a new death by rope out of Missouri. Case is 4 months old. Looks similar." As always, Jerry grimaced at the news of another murder, and, as always, she jumped to the conclusion that it was Bannock. But she'd had enough and didn't want to spend more money and waste more energy. How similar? No photos yet, no description of the rope, but no suspects and nothing from the scene. She reminded herself that 300 people a year were murdered by strangulation, and about 60% of those cases were eventually solved. That left 120 cold cases, far too many to blame on one man. "Let me sleep on it." In other words, don't start your clock at $200 an hour. Kenny Lee had led her to four of Bannock's victims, and she had paid him enough. "Sweet dreams. Still snowing up there?" She mailed him cash payments to a post office box in Camden, Maine. She assumed he lived somewhere around there. "As we speak, What's your body count now?
8.
7 by the rope and Dunwoody. It's time for help. Gotta stop this guy. I have contacts.
So do I.
Things are moving.
Okay.
20.
The task force gathered in its workroom late Monday morning and compared notes. 20 days into the assessment period, and they had little to show for their efforts. Lacey recounted for Sadell's benefit their trip to Marathon, but the poor lady was either half asleep or stoned from her pain meds. Darren, though, had some interesting news. Sipping his high-end coffee, he said, "So I had a chat with a Mr. Larry Toscano, partner in the Miami firm of Payne and Steinholtz, which has descended all these many years from Payne and Gruber, the old firm where Bannock spent the summer of 1989 as an intern. Toscano at first was reluctant to get involved, but when I explained that the BJC does possess subpoena powers in certain cases and that, if necessary, we would raid their offices and start snatching files, which of course is a joke with our limited staff, but anyway, the bluff worked and Toscano fell in line. He found the records in short order and confirmed that Bannock did indeed work there the summer before his last year of law school. He said the kid's file was clean and he did good work, got high marks from his supervisor and such, but was not offered an associate's position. I pressed Toscano for more details and he had to go back to the file. Seems as if there were 27 interns that summer from a variety of law schools and that everyone but Bannock received an offer of employment. 21 accepted. I asked why Bannock got stiffed if his file was clean, and of course Toscano had no clue. At the time, Perry Kroenke was one of two managing partners and was in charge of their summer intern program. Toscano said there is a copy of a letter in the file from Kroenke to Bannock in which no job was offered. He sent me a copy of the entire file, again, after I mentioned a subpoena.
There's not much to it, but it does prove what we already knew, that their paths crossed in 1989.
Sadell sucked in some air and growled, "And tell me again, how did Betty Rowe know about this connection?"
Lacey said, "She says in her complaint that she found a former partner of the big firm, a guy same age as Bannock, and he was in the intern class of 1989. Thus, he knew Bannock well. Maybe still does, for all we know. Says he really wanted the job and took the rejection hard."
Sadell said, "Added it to his list. Take a name now, kicking ass years later."
Something like that. 20+ years.
"Sure hope I haven't done anything to upset him, but I'm more than half dead anyway."
"Enough of that."
"You'll outlive all of us," Darren said. "Wanna bet?"
"How do I collect if I win?"
"Good point."
Lacey closed the file and looked at her task force. "So, folks, where exactly are we now? We know that Bannock knew two of the victims, which was alleged by Betty in her complaint. As I've said, she has given me documentation, off the record so far, of 5 more murders involving 5 more victims who had the misfortune of angering Judge Bannock somewhere along the way. Thankfully, we don't have to worry about those."
"Why don't we just go to the state police?"
Sadell asked. "Because they're already on the case. Have been from the Kroenke murder. We saw the file, hundreds of pages."
"Thousands," Darren said.
"Okay, thousands. They talked to dozens of people who knew Kroenke in and around Marathon, nothing. They checked every boat rental record, every fuel purchase, every new fishing license, nothing. They talked to his former law partners in Miami, nothing. And former clients, nothing. His family, nothing. They've done a thorough job of digging into the victim's past and present and they have come up with exactly nothing. Not a decent lead anywhere. They've done their work, have nothing to show for it, and so it's just sitting there, another cold case waiting on a miracle.
Darren said, I'm flying back down to Miami on Wednesday to meet with the state investigators. I've talked to them several times on the phone, and they seem willing to at least indulge us. I'm sure I'll see the same file we saw in Marathon, but you never know.
Maybe they know something that Chief Turnbull doesn't.
Sadell wheezed and said, so why not tell him about Bannock? If we know the killer's name, or at least we have a sworn complaint alleging he did it, why not hand that information over to the investigators?
She arched her shoulders and braced for another intake. Her machine hummed a bit louder as she strained.
I mean, look, Lacey, we're just spinning our wheels here. There's really not much for us to do. The real cops have billion-dollar budgets, everything from bloodhounds to helicopters and satellites, and they can't solve the crimes. How are we supposed to? I say we punt this thing over to the state police and let them go after him.
Darren said, that's where it's headed.
Lacey said, maybe so, but I promised Betty we wouldn't involve the police until she approves. That's not how we operate, Lacey, Sadell said. Once the complaint is filed, it becomes our jurisdiction. The complaining party is not allowed to dictate how we proceed. You know that.
I do, but thanks for the lecture.
Don't mention it.
She's using us, Lacey, Darren said. Just like we discussed last week, Betty wants to hide behind us and get the police involved. So that's our next step.
We'll see.
Go to Miami, meet with the state boys, and give us a report next Monday. That afternoon, Lacey left early and drove across town to a complex filled with two-story office buildings. The suite owned by R. Buford Furr was quiet, plush, well-appointed, and spoke of a successful lawyer. There were no other clients waiting in the reception area, and a handsome young intern was answering the phone. At precisely 4, he escorted Lacey back to a sprawling war room where Buford did battle with the world. He hugged her warmly as if they had been friends for years and showed her to a sofa that probably cost more than her car. Furr was one of the top trial lawyers in Florida and had many large verdicts to brag about, which he did, with framed newspaper headlines and photos on his walls. All lawyers knew of him. And when Lacey had decided to sue over the staged car wreck that injured her and killed Hugo Hatch, her former colleague, she really had no choice. Verna Hatch, Hugo's widow, hired him first, and they filed a wrongful death action seeking $10 million. A week later, Furr sued on Lacey's behalf. The lawsuits had been stymied by an unusual obstacle, an abundance of cash. The crime syndicate that had skimmed millions from an Indian casino had buried its loot around the world. The feds were still finding it, and the fact that there was so much of it was attracting an astonishing number of aggrieved parties and their lawyers. The state and federal court dockets were loaded with claims. The most serious impediment to a resolution was a huge and complicated federal lawsuit involving the conflicting claims of the Native Americans who owned the casino. Until that mess was settled, no one really knew how much cash would be left for the other aggrieved parties, including Lacey and Verna Hatch. Furr walked her through the latest developments in the asset forfeiture proceedings and other litigation. He frowned when he said, Lacey, I'm afraid they want to take your deposition.
I don't want to go through that, she said. We've talked about this.
I know. One problem is that the attorneys appointed by the court to hand out the money are working by the hour at very good rates
and they're in no hurry to wrap things up.
Gee, I've never heard that before.
Fur laughed and said, we're not talking about small-town Tallahassee rates. These guys are billing $800 an hour. We'll be lucky if there's anything left.
Can't you complain to the judges?
There are lots of complaints. Everything is contentious right now.
Lacey thought for a moment as Fur watched her.
A depot won't be that bad, he said. She said, I'm not sure I can relive that car crash. The image of Hugo covered in blood. Dying, I guess. We'll have you prepped. You'll need the experience because you may have to take the stand if the case goes to trial.
I don't want a trial, Buford. I've made myself clear. I'm sure you would like a big production with plenty of bad guys sitting at the defense table, the jury in your pocket, as always, another big verdict.
Fur laughed. That's what I live for, Lacey. Can you imagine hauling those crooks back from prison to sit through a trial? It's a lawyer's dream.
Well, it's not mine. I can handle a deposition, but not a trial.
I really want to settle, Buford.
We will, I promise. But right now, we have to play the discovery game.
I'm not sure I'm up to it.
You want to dismiss our case?
No. I want it to go away after we settle. I still have nightmares, and the lawsuit doesn't help.
I understand, Lacey. Just trust me, okay? I've been down this road many times. You deserve a generous settlement, and I promise I'll get one.
She nodded her gratitude.
21.
Sergeant Faldo was re-indexing rape kits when the phone in his pocket rattled. It was his boss, the boss, the chief of all Pensacola police, and he was as blunt as usual. He said that Judge Ross Bannock needed to check an old file that afternoon. He would be in court until at least 4, but would meet with Faldo at precisely 4:30. Faldo was ordered to do whatever his honor wanted. Just kiss his ass, okay?
Yes, sir,
Faldo shot back. He did not need to be told how to handle his job. He vaguely recalled that Bannock had been there before, years earlier. It was unusual for a circuit court judge, or any other judge for that matter, to stop by the evidence warehouse. Faldo's visitors were almost exclusively cops working on cases, bringing in evidence to be stored until trial, or digging through old files. But then Faldo had learned decades earlier that the treasure trove of old clues he guarded might attract just about anyone. He had logged in private investigators, reporters, novelists, desperate families looking for shreds of evidence, even a medium and at least one witch. At 4:30, Judge Bannock appeared with a pleasant smile and said hello. He seemed genuinely pleased to meet the sergeant and asked about his distinguished career on the force. Always the politician, he thanked Faldo for his service and asked him to call if he ever needed anything. At issue was an old file from way back. The year was 2001. A case in city court, a dismissal, a trivial matter that was of no consequence to anyone but a retired friend down in Tampa who needed a favor. And so the fiction went. As they withdrew into the bowels of the warehouse, chatting about football, Faldo seemed to remember something about the file. He found April, May, then June, and pulled out an entire drawer. Defendant's name is Verno, Bannock said, as he watched Faldo thumb through the row of files.
Here it is, Faldo said proudly as he removed it and handed it over.
Bannock adjusted his reading glasses and asked, anybody looked at this lately? Now he remembered.
Yes, sir.
Guy came in a few weeks back, oddly enough. I copied his driver's license. Should be right there.
Bannock pulled out a sheet of paper,
and looked at the face of one Jeff Dunlap of Conyers, Georgia.
What did he want?
Don't know, other than the file. I copied it for him, $1 a pop. $4, as I recall.
And he further recalled that Dunlap dropped a $5 bill on the counter because Faldo only used credit cards, but decided not to mention this.
It was a small theft, just a bit of graft by a veteran police officer who had always been grossly underpaid. Bannock studied the pages, his reading glasses balanced intelligently at the very tip of his nose.
Who redacted the name of the complaining party, he asked,
not really expecting Faldo to have an answer.
Well, it was probably you, sir, according to my logbook up front. Only two people have had any interest in that file in the past 13 years. You, 23 months ago, and now this Dunlap fellow.
But Faldo read the situation correctly and wanted no trouble.
I have no idea, sir.
Okay.
Can you run me a copy of this guy's driver's license?
Yes, sir.
Judge Bannock drove away in his Ford SUV, nothing flashy, nothing to attract attention. Never.
A private detective from Georgia traveled to Pensacola to dig through a useless old police file some 13 years after the case was closed. In doing so, he found the scant records of the arrest and trial of Lanny Verno, may he rest in peace. Odd and hard to explain, other than the obvious explanation that someone was digging through his past. Bannock's mind had been spinning for 24 hours, and he was eating ibuprofen to fight the headaches. It was crucial to think clearly, smartly, slowly, and to see around corners, but many images were blurred. He drove to the north side of Pensacola and stopped at a shopping center, one of two he owned. There was a Kroger on one end and a cinema fourplex at the other, and in between there were 8 smaller businesses, all current with their rents. He parked near a popular gym, one that he used almost every day, and walked along a covered sidewalk like any other shopper. Between the gym and a yoga studio, he turned into a wide covered alley and stopped at an unmarked door where he scanned a key card and stared into the facial scanner. The door clicked, and he quickly went inside. He turned off the alarms as the door closed behind him. It was his other chamber, his sanctum, his refuge, his cave. No windows, only one entrance, heavily alarmed and watched around the clock by hidden cameras. There was no record of its existence, no business permits, no utility bills, no access by anyone other than him. Electricity, water, sewer, internet, and cable were siphoned from the gym on the other side of a thick wall, and the rent was adjusted accordingly by a handshake deal with the lessee. It was technically in violation of a few petty ordinances and regulations, and as a judge, he didn't like the fact that he was cheating a little. But no one would ever know. The privacy afforded by his other chamber far outweighed any nagging feelings of guilt. He lived 10 miles away in the town of Cullman, in a fine home, with the usual busy man's office, one that could be easily raided by men with warrants. And his professional office was his rather somber chambers on the second floor of the Chavez County Courthouse, a space owned by the taxpayers and, though not exactly open to the public, clearly susceptible to being searched. Let them come. Let them seize all the files and computers in his home and his official chambers, and they would not find one shred of evidence against him. They could stalk him online, dig through his computers and judicial data server files, trace every email he'd ever sent from those computers, and they would find nothing. He had lived most of his adult life in fear of arrest, of warrants, of detectives, of getting caught. The fear had so thoroughly consumed him for so long that his daily routines included all manner of cautionary moves. And he remained, so far, ahead of the bloodhounds. The fear of getting caught was not driven by the fear of paying the price. Rather, it was the fear of having to stop. His passion for technology, security, surveillance, off-the-wall science, even espionage, was rooted in a movie he had long since forgotten the name of. He had watched it as a frightened and damaged 13-year-old boy, alone in the basement one night after his parents had gone to bed. The protagonist was a scrawny misfit of a kid who was the favorite target of neighborhood bullies. Instead of lifting weights and learning karate, he delved into the world of weird science, spycraft, weaponry, ballistics, even chemical warfare. He bought the first computer in town and taught himself how to program it. In due course, he exacted revenge on the bullies and rode off into the sunset. It wasn't much of a movie, but it inspired young Ross Bannock to embrace science and technology. He begged his parents for an Apple II computer for Christmas and birthday too. Plus, he tossed in $450 of his own savings. Throughout high school and college, every paycheck and every spare dollar went for the latest upgrade, the latest gadget. In his younger days, he had secretly tapped phones, filmed frat brothers having sex with their girlfriends, recorded lectures that were off limits, disabled surveillance cameras, picked locks, entered secured offices, and taken 100 other stupid chances that he never regretted. He had never been caught, not even close. The arrival of the internet presented him with endless possibilities. He took off his tie and jacket and tossed them on a leather sofa, a place he often slept. He had clothes in a closet in the rear, a small fridge with sodas and fruit drinks. There was a cafe 100 yards away near the cinema, and he often ate there alone when working late. He walked to a thick metal door, punched a code, waited for the lead bolts to release, then opened it and walked deeper inside his secret world. The vault, as he proudly called it, but only when talking to himself, was a 15-foot square office that was soundproof, fireproof, waterproof, everything-proof. No one had ever seen it, and no one ever would. There was a desk in the center with 2 30-inch computer screens. One wall was covered with IP cameras showing his home, office, courthouse, and the building he was in. On one wall, there was a 60-inch plasma screen television. The other two walls were bare. No ego puffery, no awards, commendations, diplomas. All that junk was preserved on walls that could be seen. Indeed, there was nothing anywhere in his other chamber that would indicate who owned the place. The name of Ross Bannock was nowhere to be found. If he dropped dead tomorrow, his computers and phones would wait patiently for 48 hours, then wipe themselves clean. He sat at his desk, flipped on his computer, and waited for the screen to come to life. He pulled the two letters out of his briefcase and placed them in front of him. The one in an envelope was postmarked Pensacola and informed him of the BJC investigation. The other, a silly poem, was in the envelope postmarked Montgomery. Both sent by the same person at about the same time. He went online, activated his VPN to blow past security walls, and passworded his way into the dark web, where Rafe was always waiting. As an employee of the state, Bannock had long ago hacked his way into the data networks of Florida's government. Using his customized spyware, called Maggots, he had created his own data sleuth, a troll he christened Rafe, who roamed the systems and cloud with total anonymity. Because Rafe was not a criminal, was not stealing or holding data for ransom, but rather was only nosing around for esoteric information, his chances of being discovered were almost zero. Rafe could, for example, observe internal memos between the seven members of the Florida Supreme Court and their clerks, and Bannock would know precisely how one of his cases on appeal would be decided. Since he couldn't do anything about the case, the information was basically useless, but it was certainly interesting to know which way the wind was blowing. Rafe could also see sensitive correspondence between the attorney general and the governor. He could read comments made by prosecutors about sitting judges. He could dig deep into the files of the state police and report their progress or lack of it. And, most importantly at that moment, Rafe could watch the goings-on at the Board on Judicial Conduct. Bannock checked it for the second day in a row and found nothing with his name on it. This was confusing and troublesome. Hell, at that moment, everything was troublesome. He swallowed more ibuprofen and thought about a shot of vodka, but he was not much of a drinker and planned to go to the gym. He needed 2 hours of pounding weights to break the stress. It was amusing to read the complaints currently being investigated by BJC. He relished the allegations against his fellow members of the judiciary, a few of whom he knew well, a couple of whom he despised. Prolonged amusement, though, was out of the question. Bannock reveled in his wrongdoing. The other complaints at BJC were chicken feed compared to his crimes. But now, someone else knew his history, and if a complaint had been filed against him, why was it being hidden? This ramped up the head spinning, and he reached for the pills. The person who sent the letter and the poem knew the truth. That person mentioned Kroenke, Verno, and Dunwoody, and suggested others. How much did they know? If that person had filed the complaint with BJC, then he or she did so only with an agreement that there would be no record of it, at least not for the 45-day assessment period. He went to a small room in the rear, undressed, took a long hot shower, and put on workout clothes. Back at his desk, he sent Rafe into the confidential files of the state police. Files so sensitive and protected that Rafe had been waltzing through them for almost 3 years now. He found the Perry Kroenke file from the town of Marathon and was stunned to see a fresh entry by Detective Grimsley, the state's lead investigator. It read, "Call today from Chief Turnbull in Marathon. He had a visit on March 31st from two lawyers with the Florida Board on Judicial Conduct, Lacey Stoltz and Darren Trope. They said they were curious about the murder of Kroenke, said they might have a suspect but would not divulge anything, gave no names. They went to the approx site of where Kroenke was found, revealed nothing. They left and promised to contact later." Turnbull was not too impressed, said he expects to hear nothing back, said no action needed on our part. He had left nothing behind the Kroenke killing. He had even dipped himself into the ocean. "Might have a suspect," he repeated to himself. After 23 years of remaining invisible, was it possible that someone finally considered him to be a suspect? If so, then who? It wasn't Lacey Stoltz or Darren Trope. They were simply low-level bureaucrats reacting to a complaint, one filed by the same person who was now sending him mail. Deep breathing and meditation did nothing to break the stress. He started for the vodka, but left for the gym, locking his other chamber behind himself, always careful, always noticing everything, every person. As bewildered and frightened as he was, he told himself to relax and think clearly. He walked around the corner to the fitness center and joined a hot yoga class for 20 minutes of sweating before he hit the iron.
22. On Friday morning, April 11th, Norris Osment had just arrived at his desk off the main reception area at the Pelican Point Resort when a call came through his landline from the hotel operator. A Judge Bannock from over in Cullman. Curious that he should hear the judge's name again so soon, Osment took the call. They claimed to remember each other from Osment's old days with the Pensacola police. Then, with that door wide open, Bannock said, "I'm chasing a rabbit for an old friend down in Tampa, and I'm looking for some info regarding a Lanny Verno. Looks like a real lowlife. Got himself murdered a few months back over in Biloxi. He had a case in city court years ago, and you were the arresting officer. Any of this ring a bell?" "Well, Judge, normally it would not ring any bell, but now it does. I remember the case." "No kidding. It was 13 years ago." "Yes, sir, it was. You swore out a warrant, and I arrested Verno." "That's right," Bannock said with a loud fake laugh. "That guy pulled a gun on me in my own house, and the judge let him go." "A long time ago, Judge. I don't miss those days in city court, and I've tried to forget them. I'm sure I wouldn't have remembered the case, but a private detective showed up last month asking questions about Verno."
"You don't say?"
"Yes, sir."
"What did he want?"
"Just said he was curious."
"Well, if you don't mind my asking, what was he curious about?"
Actually, Osment was bothered by his asking, but Panic was a circuit judge with jurisdiction over criminal matters. He could probably subpoena the resort's records if he wanted to. He was also involved in the prosecution of Verno as the alleged victim. These thoughts rattled around as Osment debated how much to say.
"He said Verno had been murdered and that he had been hired by his family in Georgia to chase down some gossip about a couple of stray children he might have left behind."
"Where was this guy from?"
"Said he was from Georgia, the Atlanta area, Conyers."
"Did you keep an ID?"
"No, sir."
"He never offered a business card. I never asked for one, didn't offer him one either. But our cameras got his car in the parking lot, and we tracked the tags. It was a Hertz rental out of Mobile."
"Interesting."
"I guess. At the time, I just figured he flew from Atlanta to Mobile and rented the car. To be honest, Judge, I didn't give it much thought. It was a petty criminal case in city court 100 years ago, and the defendant, Verno, was found not guilty. Now somebody killed him over in Mississippi. Not really much of my business."
"I see.
Did you get a look at his car?"
"Yes, sir. It's on video."
"Mind emailing it to me?"
"Well, I'll have to check with our manager. We may have some security issues."
"I'm happy to speak with your manager." The statement had a slightly threatening tone to it. He was a judge, and as such, was accustomed to getting what he wanted. A pause as Osment glanced around his empty office.
"Sure, Judge. Give me your email."
His Honor gave him a temporary address, one of many he used and discarded, and half an hour later, he was looking at two photos. One, a rear shot of a white Buick sedan with Louisiana license plates, the second from the same camera with Jeff Dunlap in the frame. Bannock sent an email back to Osment saying thanks, and attached to it a useless brochure describing the mission and duties of the judges and officers of Florida's 22nd Judicial District. When Osment opened and downloaded it, maggots entered through the back door, and Pelican Point's network was immediately infected. Not that Bannock would ever need to snoop, but he suddenly had access to the resort's guest lists, financial records, personnel files, tons of credit card and banking data. And not just Pelican Point. It was part of a small chain of 20 boutique resorts, and Rafe now had even more to explore if he ever wanted to. But there were more pressing matters. Bannock called his office and spoke with his clerk.
Other than an 11 o'clock attorney conference, there was nothing important on his schedule. There were 7 Jeff or Jeffrey Dunlaps in the Atlanta area, but only 2 in the town of Conyers. One was a school teacher whose wife sounded like a 15-year-old. The other was a retired city bus driver who said he had never been to Mobile. Both confirmed what Bannock suspected from the outset. Jeff Dunlap was a bogus front for the private detective. He would track down the other 5 later, just to be sure. He called a Hertz office in Mobile and spoke to a young woman named Janet, who was quite helpful and zipped through the details of his weekend rental. She emailed the confirmation to one of Bannock's addresses, and he replied with, "Thanks, Janet. The quote I received differs from your confirmation by $120. Please review the attached and address this discrepancy." As soon as Janet opened the attachment, Rafe sneaked through the back door of Hertz North America. Bannock hated hacking such large corporations because their security was much more sophisticated. But as long as Rafe just snooped and didn't try to steal or extort, he would probably go undetected. Bannock would wait a few hours and cancel the rental. In the meantime, he sent Rafe to the registration records for Hertz vehicles titled in Louisiana. From prior experience, he knew that Hertz rented 500,000 vehicles in the U.S. and allocated their registrations to all 50 states. Enterprise, the largest car rental company, did the same with over 600,000 vehicles. It proved to be a bit of a slog for Rafe, though he never complained, never stopped. He was programmed to work around the clock, every day of the week if necessary. While he labored in the shadows, Bannock worked the phone to make sure all Jeff Dunlaps in the Atlanta area checked out. At 10:30, he straightened his tie, examined himself in the mirror, and thought he looked quite haggard and worried, with good reason. He had slept little. Now the sky was falling. For the first time in his life, he felt like he was on the run. He drove 15 minutes to the Escambia County Courthouse in Pensacola for his meeting. The lawyers were all from downtown, and he had scheduled around their convenience. He managed to flip a switch and appear as warm and personable as always. He listened to each side and promised a quick mediation. Then he hustled back to his other chamber and locked himself inside. On March 11th, the Buick was rented to one Raleigh Tabor, a private investigator licensed by the state of Alabama. He used it for 2 days and returned it on March 12th, traveling only 421 miles. Tabor's online presence was quite meager, which was true of most private investigators. They tended to advertise only enough to attract business, but not enough to reveal anything useful. His website claimed that he was a former detective, experienced, trustworthy, confidential. What was it supposed to say? He handled missing persons, divorce, child custody, background investigations, the usual. Downtown Mobile office address, office phone number, and email. There was no vanity photograph of Tabor. Comparing the security camera shot taken at the resort to the bogus driver's license copied by Sergeant Faldo, it was clear that the same man, one who called himself Jeff Dunlap, had been to both places, snooping around for information about Lanny Verno. The man was really Raleigh Tabor, so why was he lying? Bannock plotted and schemed for an hour, discarding one ruse after the other. When inspiration finally hit, he set up another email account and sent Tabor a note. "Dear Mr. Tabor, I'm a physician in Birmingham, and I need the services of a private investigator in the Mobile area. A possible domestic relations matter. You have been highly recommended. Are you available? And if so, what is your hourly rate? Dr. Albert Marbury,
Bannock sent the email, tracked it, and waited. 31 minutes later, Tabor opened it and replied, "Dr. Marbury, thank you. I am available. My rate is $200 an hour, RT. Bannock scoffed at the $200 an hour, obviously the doctor's rate. He sent back an email agreeing to the rate and attached a link to a hotel website in Gulf Shores where he suspected his wife might be staying. When Tabor opened the email and looked at the attachment, Rafe slid through the back door and was on the prowl. He began by looking for current clients. Tabor's record keeping was rudimentary at best, at least for the data he entered into his computer. Bannock knew full well that a lot of PIs kept two sets of books, one for the IRS, the other for themselves. Cash was still a popular lubricant. After an hour, he had found nothing. No mention of Lanny Verno or Jeff Dunlap or the trip to Pensacola and Seagrove Beach a month earlier, and certainly no clue as to the identity of the client behind the investigation. He ate ibuprofen and took some Valium to settle his nerves. He realized he was weak with hunger, but his systems were raging, and he was afraid to tempt his stomach with more food. He was tired of the vault, and at the moment, he wanted to get behind the wheel and just drive, just go, hit the open road and get the hell out of town for the weekend. Maybe from a distant pier or beach or mountain, he could look back with an unclouded eye and make sense of it. Someone knew. And that someone knew a lot. He walked out of the vault and went to the small room in the rear where he stripped to his boxers and pulled on gym shorts and a t-shirt. He needed fresh air, a hike in the woods, but he couldn't leave, not at this crucial moment. He found an orange in the fridge and ate it with black coffee. Maggots had been hiding in the shadows of the Harrison County Sheriff's Department since the killings of Lanny Verno and Mike Dunwoody. After they were found, Rafe came to life and began nosing around. When the orange was finished, Bannock said hello to Rafe and sent him to the files of Detective Napier, the chief investigator in Biloxi. In a daily log, Napier had entered a note on March 25th. Meeting today with Lacey Stoltz and Darren Trope of the Florida Board on Judicial Conduct, re the Verno Dunwoody murders. Allowed them access to the file, but nothing was taken or copied. They made a vague reference to a suspect, but would provide no details. They know more than they are willing to say. We'll follow up. E. Napier. Bannock cursed and walked away from his desk. He felt like a bleeding animal stumbling through the woods as the bloodhounds drew closer and louder. Eileen was number four. Eileen Nickelberry. Age 32 at the time of her death. Divorced, according to her obituary. He loved collecting his obits. They were all in the files. He found her 13 years later. 13 years after she mocked him in his frat house bedroom. 13 years after she had stumbled downstairs, drunk like all the rest, and broadcast to the rest of the party that Ross couldn't get it up, couldn't perform. She laughed and ran her big mouth, though by the next morning, most of the Hellraisers had forgotten the incident. But she kept talking, and word spread through their circles. Bannock has a problem. Bannock can't perform. 6 years later, he found his first victim, the Scoutmaster. His killing had gone as perfectly as planned. There was not one shred of remorse, not even a twinge of pity.